Fraser, it's wonderful to be speaking with you today and to see you, of course, but listeners to the podcast won't be able to see you, but you are wearing yellow and blue, the colours of Ukraine this week.
Indeed, yes, I am. I'm thinking of the 1 year on from the Russia's further invasion of Ukraine, which obviously is a subject that's been very much at the top of our minds around the world.
You know, in just 2 years, Western democracy's been assailed with the unthinkable. A mob stormed the US Capitol to overthrow the election in 2021, January the 6th, 2021. And a little over 2 years later, Vladimir Putin launches his invasion of Ukraine, the first full-blown state-on-state land war in Europe since 1945. Can democracy survive, assailed from within and without?
My two answers to that are, first, yes, but secondly, it has to. I think for those of us who really believe in what we've always traditionally called Western values, but who believe in law and order, who believe in freedom of thought, of freedom of speech, of opportunity for people. I mean, I think we must ensure that democracy does survive. And I think that's one of the things that worries me, as you talked about, two manifestations, external manifestations, if you like, the mob and the war. But what worries me is that there's evidence that in terms of polling research that suggests that young people in the United States and in the United Kingdom are less likely to think that democracy is the best way to run a government. And I think it's very important that those of us who believe in democracy actually go out there and make the case for it and make the case that this is a system that can respond to people's needs and provide for people's needs and works for people.
Do you think that there's been a change, Teresa, in the media environment that is, you know, creating this sort of anti-democratic populist context in Western democracies? I mean, we cast our mind back to when, you know, we first met at the Oxford Union debating each other in the, you know, 1970s, late 1970s.
I wish you hadn't given the date, Malcolm.
Sorry. All right. I apologise for that. Yes. Well, at least it's not the 1870s. But you know, when we met, essentially the media, if you wanted to get your message across to the media, in the media you had a number of big platforms, newspapers, television, radio. They were all curated. There was no such thing as social media. There was no internet. But now you seem to have a free-for-all where anyone can publish whatever they like and reach audiences of billions. Increasingly, people are being targeted directly. And, of course, some of the mainstream media has become reckless to the point of really endangering democracy. I mean, the way in which, you know, Fox News in particular in the United States propagated the lie that Biden had stolen the election really gave the mob its casus belli. You know, that was there, that the reason they were there was because they thought Donald Trump was the legitimate president and that Biden had stolen the election, and that's what they were being told. I mean, that kind of falsehood, it seems to me, would not have got propagated 20 years ago. I mean, am I just being sentimental in reminiscing about the past? What do you think?
No, I think there's certainly an element to what you say. I would say three things have happened. First of all, we've seen the onset of social media, which means that people do go out there and say anything on social media and it's picked up. And I've always described it as thinking of it as the sort of chap who used to sit at the end of the bar in his local pub muttering into his pint of beer, and nobody paid any attention to him because his views were so strange or so extreme. Now he can mutter across the social media and suddenly everybody else sitting on the end of a bar in a pub somewhere, muttering into their beer their strange views, picks up on this and responds, and it becomes a worldview. And it is then proliferated across social media. So social media certainly had an impact. I think also, as we've seen 24-hour broadcast media, that has forced the print media, what we would call the traditional print media, to become more sensationalist. But I think the other thing, and I think this is what we see in America particularly, is the polarization of media. So that we pride ourselves here in the United Kingdom on the BBC. The BBC is politically neutral. It has to make sure that what it's saying, they've stood the stories up, they've got the evidence, they've got the backing. In the polarized media in the United States, you know, if you've of one particular political viewpoint, you use one for one particular news broadcaster, and a different viewpoint might go to will go to a different broadcaster. And I think that polarization means that what people are being are listening to and watching all the time is just reinforcing a particular view rather than giving the general arguments and enabling people to come to their own decisions. They're, if you like, they're constantly getting, as they can do on some aspects of social media, the same view being fed back to them.
Yes, and you've got algorithms that run the social media platforms that will basically deliver people more and more content that riles them up, because the longer they're angrier and more engaged, the longer they stay on the platform and hence the more revenue. There's been a really interesting revelation in the Dominion voting machine case in the United States. I don't know whether it's been widely reported in the UK, but they have been suing Fox over the falsehood that was published on Fox and other platforms, that the Dominion voting machines were corrupt and, you know, had been manipulated by Hugo Chavez and so forth, you know, really bonkers stuff. But having said that, a lot of people believed it. And what's come out in the discovery, in the legal proceedings, is a lot of internal correspondence between the senior people at Fox, including the on-air presenters, saying to each other, this is all, all of this stuff that Trump's going on about, saying the election was stolen, is lies, it's nonsense. But nonetheless, that's what our audience wants to hear. So they kept on telling them. And of course, the consequences were what happened. Do you think that, I mean, Trump was a phenomenon to me. I mean, you and I were among the first leaders to meet him as president. I don't know whether you found him as confronting as I did. But I'd never seen anyone in public life like that. And almost every day he seemed to do something that in my political experience would have been a sort of a self-destructive event. You know, he got more and more outrageous, but it didn't seem to affect his popularity. And I mean, in some, you know, it's up to you just what you say about British politics, but there have been a few personalities in the United Kingdom in recent years that have had some resonance with that. I mean, do you think this sort of outrageous, fact-free populism is a sort of irresistible trend in Western democracies, or do you think voters will wake up to the fact that these mountebanks and charlatans are what they, you know, in fact what they are, phonies?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right. Donald Trump was a president like no other. It was... You know, we all had our different experiences of him. My experience, as you may recall, because the photographs were shown, was that amazing thing of having gone to the White House fairly early on after his inauguration and suddenly discovering myself walking out in front of the world's press with him holding my hand, which I have to say, I don't think any other world leader did at any stage. Even you,
well,
Malcolm,
he's only human.
Long before.
Yes, that's true. That's right. Yes, I know, it's pretty odd. Mind you, the Vietnamese Prime Minister held my hand once at an APEC meeting, but I think that seems to be more okay in Vietnam.
Well, I've not been to Vietnam, so I've not had that experience. But I think that was a sort of just a personal story, but it shows the one word that I would use about Donald Trump and his presidency, which was unpredictability. And I think that was one of the difficulties, certainly, of dealing with that Trump presidency, was that unpredictability. But he came to office with a very simple message for the American people, which was, you know, make America great again, the America first message, which people could easily tap into and latch onto. I think that if you look at politics, actually, I think what I read here in the UK is that what people fundamentally want, and I think this is probably the same in most places, is governments that get on with the job of dealing with the issues that are mattering to that matter to them on a day-to-day basis. We live in a world of celebrity, so nobody minds that concept of somebody who is sort of flamboyant or not just your normal politician. People always want the backstory. They want to hear more about people. But at the end of the day, they want you as a politician to actually do the job, to represent them, to understand the issues that matter to them and to deliver for them. And I think one of the issues for populism has been because many people have felt perhaps that the politicians in charge, their governments haven't been delivering for them on the issues that they really cared about. And so when presented with a very simple message that appears to give an easy answer to their problems, they've gone with that.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think this gets back to the point you made about people, particularly young people, losing faith in democracy, because if you can have a perfectly democratic system in the sense that everyone gets the vote, gets the right to vote, the votes are counted honestly and efficiently, the process works. But if the outcome is such that the fundamental work of government is not done satisfactorily and people feel, they're not being supported, they feel there's corruption and so forth, then they could be amenable to a populace saying, well, the answer is not this democracy business, it's strong leadership. And of course, that's exactly what the dictators did between the two world wars. Turning to dictators, and as you know better than anyone, a particularly poisonous one, Vladimir Putin, who, attempted to assassinate with Novichok, a very deadly poison, you stood up to him in a way other leaders in the West were not. You stood up to him and led a concerted Western response. With your leadership, we withdrew diplomats and imposed sanctions. So you had a close engagement with Putin, Teresa. How did you assess him then, and how do you assess him now? Because there is a view that he has actually gone mad. And I say that, having known him since 2007, so that's quite a long time, I'd always found him to be just what he was, like a former KGB officer, very calculating, very rational. Obviously with an agenda that was not consistent with our ideals of democracy, to say the least, but a calculated person. And yet with this invasion of Ukraine, it seems such a reckless gamble. Do you think he's lost the plot, or do you think this was just another calculated gamble that has gone awry from his point of view?
Well, if I may, first of all, you referenced what happened in Salisbury and the attempts on the lives of Sergei and Yulia Skripal. Of course, sadly, one person did die, Dawn Sturgis, who was a British citizen who, it was a little while afterwards, her partner found the glass vial, the perfume bottle in which they'd carried, the agents had carried the Novichok, and unfortunately gave it to her, and the effect was that she died. And I think that showed the recklessness of the attack that took place against the Skripals, because that could have been picked up by children. It could have been, the impact could have been much greater. Very sadly, one person died. And obviously, we took the action, and I'm grateful to Australia and to all the other countries that stood alongside us and gave that very clear message to Russia. You can't do this. You must not use chemical weapons, and you must not use chemical weapons on the streets of one of our cities. As to Putin himself and the invasion of Ukraine, in terms of him as an individual, I may actually not have had quite as much direct dealings with him as you have, because it was over a shorter period of time. And after Salisbury, we were very careful that it was not business as usual with Russia. But what I always found was, he was a very cold fish. So I think your word of calculating is still relevant. But I was interested, and I noticed this in, I think, a G20 meeting. And I saw something similar in the speech that he gave recently, the so-called sort of State of Russia, State of Union speech, equivalent to the State of Union speech. Didn't engage with people around the table. You know, if you or I are sitting around the table and somebody's speaking in a meeting, you look at them, but he never really engaged with people. And when I saw him give that speech, I was only obviously watching on the television, and I have to confess I didn't watch for 2 hours, which was the length of the speech. But again, he didn't engage with the audience. He was reading very much, occasionally looked up, but there was no eye contact with others. And I think he's somebody who has surrounded himself with yes men. And if you do that, there comes a point you just come to believe your own propaganda. And I think the further invasion of Ukraine, I think, was a calculation. He thought, he's an opportunist, he thought the West's eyes were elsewhere, that we were focusing much more on China and the Indo-Pacific. He thought that the West was not as willing to unite in defense of its values. You know, I think it was early 2020 when the Munich Security Conference was about Westlessness, i.e. the unwillingness of the West to defend its values. And I think he took a calculation that the West wouldn't be able to unite, wouldn't come together, and wouldn't be willing to act. And of course, that was a complete miscalculation. And virtually everything he wanted to achieve, I mean, we know thought he'd be in Kyiv in a matter of days, of course, a year on. The war is still going on. He wanted to further divide the West united. He wanted to cause division in NATO. NATO is strengthening because we have Sweden and Finland wanting to join NATO. And he wanted fewer troops on his borders. He's got more NATO troops on his borders. So everything that he wanted to achieve, he hasn't managed to achieve. But I think perhaps recklessness in the sense that you say. I think he saw an opportunity and he takes those opportunities.
Yes, well, one way or another, he has to be defeated. There's no doubt about that. I mean, turning away from Ukraine and Putin, do you think that the UK is less susceptible to the sort of populist right-wing extremism that we've seen than, for example, the United States is? I mean, you know, we think we are in Australia and we've got We generally think part of that is our voting system, you know, compulsory voting, no gerrymandering, preferential voting. Or do you think it's just that Australians and British, assuming we are less susceptible to it, are more sensible than Americans? I mean, we could probably agree on that, you know, just between us, you know.
I think that the certainly, obviously, there have been attempts in the United Kingdom to the formation of far-right, more extreme right-wing parties. And they've always failed at the ballot box. And it's partly, I think, our voting system. We have a different system. Obviously, we have first past the post for our general elections and for our local elections. And that has meant that those parties like the BNP, like the National Front, have not been able to get their foot in the door in terms of actually being elected to Parliament. So I think there is something about the electoral system. I think probably we're feet on the ground, more slightly more pragmatic about what we expect our politicians to achieve, in a sense. And we always say in the UK that you win elections on the centre ground, and that's always been the case. And so the arguments between the two main parties are very, you know, very real arguments about how we achieve what we want to achieve. But parties that want to win elections will always be on the centre ground, because that's where the majority of the population naturally sit.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And that's really very much the case here in Australia. Interestingly, in the US, where I think the vast majority of voters are in the centre, where they are, I would imagine, pretty much anywhere, the elected representatives seem to be scattered more to the extremes of both parties than the electorate is. And so it's, you know, there's an argument that there's something at fault with their system. their electoral system and, of course, the media environment which they operate in. But, I mean, while the UK is out of Europe now, you're still part geographically part of Europe. It's not very far away. And you're
I was going to say I'm a geography graduate, Malcolm, so we are geographically part of
you're
Europe.
Definitely,
got there before
you're
me.
You're definitely part of Europe, exactly. What do you think of the prospects of or the threats of right-wing extremism in Europe? I mean, in France, of course, Emmanuel Macron, who is very much a centrist, was re-elected, but he defeated Le Pen, for an extreme figure from the right. Macron cannot, who we both know well, cannot run again because he's only got two terms. Do you think there's any chance of another centrist taking over from Macron, or is France going to be led by someone from the extreme right or the extreme left?
No, I think there is every prospect of a centrist being elected next time round in France. And if you think about it, I mean, there was a lot of talk in both the elections, times that Emmanuel Macron has been elected, of the strength of the Le Pen vote, the Marine Le Pen vote. But both times France has taken that decision to go to the centre. I think that there is one of the interesting issues in French politics is the way, of course, that the more traditional parties of the centre have not got at the moment that sort of the structures and the support. And indeed, as you say, because Emmanuel Macron, who created his own, it wasn't really a party, it was a movement, La France En Marche, now he can't stand. I think the issue will be for the centre-right parties, particularly, to come together and find a way of reinstating themselves into French politics, into the national political scene. I think that is perfectly possible. But obviously, they've got some work to do.
Yes, it was extraordinary, wasn't it? Because the traditional centre-right party and the traditional centre-left party were reduced to sort of almost statistical irrelevance as Macron took up the centre, and then his opponents became Le Pen and Mélenchon, on the extreme right and extreme left. It is a vital battle. The Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, who worked for the Brexit Leave campaign, said, "I made Steve Bannon's psychological warfare tool," Steve Bannon being the sort of evil genius behind much of Trump's campaigning. And that playbook has been exported around the world, and essentially based on really aggressive misinformation. I mean, excuse the vulgarity, but Bannon famously said that his tactic was to flood the zone with shit. In other words, to just get as much lies and disinformation out there so that people are confused, they don't trust anything, and in that context, they are, prepared to believe, wild claims, conspiracy theories, and so forth. Trump took this approach and was successful, certainly successful in getting elected, but not getting re-elected. It was very much a feature of politics in Brazil in recent times. Bolsonaro took the same approach. And I mean, then their election, you had people being accused of being Satanists and cannibals. It was just, absolutely wild stuff. I mean, if we're in an age where people can and will say anything and seem to be able to get away with it, how do we push back against that? And I mean, I just, again, lacing this with my own experience, when I was, as Prime Minister, you get asked about anything and everything. If you're the Minister for Bridges and somebody asks you about tunnels, you can say, "Oh, well, I defer to my distinguished colleague, the Minister for Tunnels, who can address that question. I'm only here to talk about bridges." But if you're the PM, you get asked about anything and everything, and you can't keep on saying, "I'll have to check with the minister," because then you look like you're not over on top of your brief. So we've known each other for years, just a few years, of course. But I imagine that you, like me, were anxious not to get your facts wrong, constantly worrying that you get a statistic wrong, a detail wrong. But Trump, and you're seeing increasingly other leaders around the world, seem to be liberated from that and literally prepared to say anything and able to get away with it. And, in, and you know, fact checkers, which, you know, there's quite a few, find that the lie will get 10 million hits and the correction will get 100,000. I mean, this has been Maria Ressa's experience in the Philippines. I mean, how do we effectively push back against this flood of lies, of disinformation, of conspiracy theories, of craziness? Because, I mean, I guess in the past we've assumed that a lot of this was harmless. You know, it doesn't really matter that 24% of Americans believe Elvis is still alive or the world is flat or whatever. But when people start believing their government is illegitimate and they then decide to take up arms, for example, you've got a major problem. So how do we deal with this flood of lies and misinformation?
I think there's several ways to deal with it, if I may. I think there's, in terms of the sort of the short term or short or medium term way, I mean, you can argue that you flood as many facts out there as possible.
Yeah.
But I think there's an issue which is about the background, the environment in which people are hearing or seeing or reading these things. And it comes back to what we were talking about earlier. If the democratic system, if the politics of today, the politicians of today are delivering for people and responding to them on the issues that matter to them, then I think they are less likely to believe the lies when the attacks come on those individuals in the sort of exaggerated way that can happen. So that getting the environment right in doing the politicians doing their job is part of it. But there's a longer term issue. And this is one of the things that concerns me about social media. It's about actually educating young people. You could argue educating everybody, but particularly I think we've got a job to do with next generations, educating them to be much more questioning of what comes across on social media, to be more discerning, and to exercise judgment and to be able to be in a position to be able to exercise that judgment rather than just accepting everything that is told to them. But of course, we all know that saying that if you say something, you know, often enough, people can start to believe that it is the truth simply because they're hearing it so frequently. So you have to, I think there's an issue which is about educating and helping people to be more discerning in responding to what they're listening to, but also setting a political scene where actually, if somebody is telling lies across social media, they're able to see that that's the case because they're able to see a political system that is actually working for them. Therefore, they're less inclined to want to believe something that is attacking, in outrageous terms, is attacking that system.
I mean, Britain, of course, Theresa's had, you know, the most momentous democratic exercise it's had in probably in centuries was the decision to leave the European Union, the Brexit referendum. I was observing this from afar. I was interested, sort of troubled by the fact that there was so little authoritative information out there for the electorate. And David Cameron told me later, and you know, our mutual friend, then the Prime Minister, that he believed that they had a better chance of winning the Brexit referendum if there wasn't a, you know, a full panoply of economic research, you know, like a royal commission into the economic consequences of Brexit or parliamentary committees with voluminous examination and report. And it did seem to me from here, a long way away, that having done that, the Brexit referendum context looked a bit like asking people to give uninformed consent. And that, of course, you know, we're having some issues like that with the referendum in Australia that's looming here too. You know, if you don't provide the information and the detail, the problem is that people will make it up and are free to speculate as they wish. Do you think that in the Brexit context, there was a sort of an environment that gave rise or enabled more populism and misinformation, or am I, is this my perception from the other end of the world, you know, mistaken?
I think, I mean, the issue around Europe had been around British politics ever since, you know, before when we were negotiating to join what was the EEC at the time and became obviously the European Union. So it had been a rumbling issue in British politics for some considerable time. I think when it came to the referendum, one of the concerns on the Remain side of the argument was, and it partly leads back to this issue about who the public, if you like, were willing to trust. And I think I think the Brexit vote, in one sense, it was just about leaving the European Union, but to a lot of people, it was about something more. It was about the fact they didn't think their politicians were listening to them on the issues that really mattered to them. They wanted change, and this was going to be a change and symbolic of that change. In your operating in that environment, I think the thing is that they would be less likely then to trust what the politicians, what the government or the politicians were saying to them about the arguments. And sadly, there was a background where they were less willing to trust business, because obviously one of the key issues during the debate was the economic argument. But there was a sense that business couldn't raise its voice too loudly because it wouldn't be believed. And of course, one of the towards the end of the referendum campaign, the government took action through the Chancellor for publishing what he said would have to be the emergency budget after any vote for Brexit. It had the opposite impact from the one that was hoped and expected, in that it turned, I think a lot of people said, for goodness sake, don't try telling us that sort of stuff. We don't believe you.
So it sounded like they were being frightened or bullied.
Exactly. Yes, that was the case. But as I say, there was just a fundamental sense for a lot of people in Britain that things had to change, and this was a vote which enabled change to take place.
Well, Theresa, I admire you, but I don't envy you. I admire you because of everything you've done, your leadership in public life as Prime Minister and in so many other important roles. But I particularly admire the fact that you're still a member of the House of Commons and participating in democracy, whereas I escaped from the House of Representatives as shortly after I stopped being Prime Minister. So you are a stayer and a player, and it's important that you keep it and we keep our democracy. And, you know, thank you very much for this time you've spent with me, and I look forward to discussing these issues with you again.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And indeed, these are important issues. And those of us who believe in democracy do need not just to talk about them but actually go out there and make the case for democracy. But thank you very much. Enjoyed the chat.
The podcast was written and produced by myself and Lisa Main. Music was composed by Helena Chaika. Listener.